Democratic primary debate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. I'm Ezra Wall, the host of the regional WPR program Newsmakers. Joining us for today's Democratic debate are candidates Ron Kind of La Crosse and Mark Newman of La Crosse. They've agreed to spend the hour with us answering questions about their campaign's ideas and the issues facing the 3rd District. The 3rd Congressional District includes all or parts of 18 counties in western and west and central Wisconsin: La Crosse, Eau Claire, Wood, Portage, Chippewa, Grant, Monroe, Dunn, Pierce, Vernon, Trempealeau, Juneau, Jackson, Adams, Richland, Crawford, Buffalo, and Pepin. Among the larger cities in the district are Eau Claire, La Crosse, Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, Menominee, River Falls, Chippewa Falls, Plover, Platteville, Sparta, and Toma. The primary election takes place August 11th. The winner of the Democratic primary will face the winner of the Republican primary between Derek Van Orden of Hagar City and Jesse Eben of Eau Claire. We've already hosted a debate between the Republican candidates in the 3rd District. You can find last week's debate on our website, WPR.org. Scroll down to the announcements section and you'll find it there. Before we begin today, thank you to the Eau Claire Chamber of Commerce for their partnership. They're providing the Paragon virtual platform from Wind Technologies of Eau Claire. That's serving as the technical backbone for today's operation. Now, let me introduce the guests of the hour. Dr. Mark Newman of La Crosse is a pediatrician, husband, and father. He practiced medicine for 35 years and spent 20 years as a Franciscan brother serving as a medical missionary in the former Zaire for part of that time. Newman earned his medical degree from St. Louis University School of Medicine in 1982. Dr. Newman, welcome to you.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse is the incumbent in this race. Prior to joining the U.S. House of Representatives in 1997, Kind was a La Crosse County prosecutor and quarterback of the football team at Harvard, where he graduated in 1985. Kind also studied at the London School of Economics and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He and his wife, Tawny, have two sons. Congressman Kind, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Ezra. Glad to be with you.
So we'll begin by asking each of you to introduce yourselves today. Starting with you, Congressman Kind, you're the incumbent. Why should voters send you to Washington for a 13th term?
Well, Ezra, first of all, thanks for hosting and for Wisconsin Public Radio for doing this forum, and to the Eau Claire Chamber. Scott Rogers, Dave up there, they do a wonderful job. And to Mark, too. Mark, thanks for participating and for offering yourself up as a candidate for this office. You know, I know how tough that is given the toxic political environment that we're in right now. But listen, I think I can represent this district well because I know the district well. I was born and raised here, raised my family here. More importantly, I think the district knows me well, too, the type of representation that I do bring. I'm constantly on the ground here, reaching out to people, very accessible. I'm still one of those few members of Congress that actually have live listening sessions in town halls to get feedback from directly from people from this district. And it makes me a more effective representative then. In fact, it's one reason why I'm rated as one of the most effective legislators in the U.S. Congress. Because of my willingness to listen back home and bring those ideas to D.C., but my ability to reach across the aisle, to get in the same room with my colleagues, including my Republican colleagues, to find common ground to get things done. It's one of the reasons why the National Chamber of Commerce just awarded me their very first national award for being the most bipartisan member of Congress. And in an era of divided government, that's the only way you can get things done. The challenges are great, and we're going to need that steady leadership as we move forward, but especially now when we're dealing with this coronavirus. You know, the truth is there's not going to be a lot of light separating Mark and myself on the major issues of the day, whether it's making sure all of our citizens have access to quality, affordable health care, recognizing that global warming is a real threat to us and the globe right now. And the real existential threat to our democracy is the current occupant of the Oval Office. But Mark and I also agree on another important thing, that there's a role for all of us to play right now to keep each other healthy and safe by washing our hands a lot, by maintaining proper distancing. And please wear facial coverings when you do go out. We know this works to prevent the spread of the virus. And by doing that, we can start reopening the economy and get our children back in school again quicker. But it comes back to people's health. And Mark dedicated his entire life to keeping people healthy and safe and that. And so I commend him for his candidacy and for his life mission with all this, and look forward to the discussion today.
Dr. Newman, Mark Newman, why should voters in Wisconsin's 3rd District take a closer look at your campaign? Tell us what best qualifies you to seek this office.
Sure, Ezra. I think I need to give a little bit of a bio because I'm a markedly less known person than Mr. Kind. I was born in Quincy, Illinois, in a river town just like La Crosse, about the same size, with deep historical roots in the 19th century, also with roots to the indigenous population. In Quincy, we have the burial sites for Illinois Indians. And when I grew up there, I met the Franciscan brothers and priests who were serving at our Catholic parish, and I loved their attitude of service and their simplicity of life and their fraternity. And so when I college, I joined the Franciscans and asked if I could serve in the international arena as a medical doctor. I was allowed to study medicine, and I spent 6 years out of a 10-year period working in Central Africa in the country that was then called Zaire. It was a rough time. Mobutu Sese Seko was the dictator who died about 1992 or so, and the country kind of fell into civil disorder and even civil war. So my experience kind of left me a little bit humbled. Some of that Albert Schweitzian idealism that got me there was sort of beat out of me. When I returned to the United States, I met my wife, and she is my avenue for marrying into Wisconsin. I lived in Madison for about 10 years. And then in 2010, I had a job opportunity to join Gunderson medical team as a pediatric critical care doctor. We live in La Crosse now, and we love this community. So that's my history. But the question is, why am I here today? Well, one thing is, I believe that when we go to vote at the polls, it's good to be able to do something, and it's good to have a choice. And leading up to an election, it's good to have more than one candidate so that we can engage in a more vigorous conversation about those things that are important to us in our community. And why did that engage me? Well, I can remember very clearly January 20th, 2017, with the inaugural speech by our current president, Trump, the American Carnage speech. That speech really affected me. I did not like the description that he offered of my America that I love. And I believe that I needed to do more than what I have done up until then in terms of my engagement as an American citizen. And so I've, at that point, been exploring and learning how to engage more actively and more assertively in the political arena, doing both electoral politics, helping other campaigns, and also doing issues politics, trying to help us to talk about and think about important issues. And so that's what brings me here today.
Well, I'm grateful for both of you being here today. A little technical note, pardon us listeners. Representative Kind, could I have you move your microphone a little bit away from your mouth? Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's perfect. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption. First question to you, Dr. Newman. Representative Kind has been in office more than 20 years. With incumbency comes influence, especially when your party is currently in power in the House. Why should voters ignore the power of incumbency in favor of your campaign, Dr. Newman?
People sometimes think that we should, I hear people propose that we should have term limits. And my response to that is that, yes, indeed, we do have term limits. When we are elected to an office, it's for a determined period of time. For the Senate, it's 6 years. For the House of Representatives, it's 2 years. And so I think the real issue is for our electorate, for the voters, to be able to recognize that every 2 years they have an opportunity to meet their representatives and others who could be interested in doing the job. And that's good for our democracy to have that periodic review, kind of a 360 review, like many of us as professionals are familiar with when we, I certainly as a doctor am familiar with it, that after a period of time, you look at how well you've done over the last year with your supervisors and look for where areas of improvement. So in the political arena, that's what we get to do when we campaign for electoral office.
Representative Kind, I'm going to flip that coin to the other side to you. In recent years, we've seen primary contests ultimately unseating establishment incumbents in both Republican and Democratic primaries. Just this week, in fact, Black Lives Matter activist Cori Bush upset incumbent Democrat Lacey Clay in Missouri. Do you think longtime incumbents such as yourself can become too comfortable in office?
Well, first, I think we need to make a distinction of who those representatives are. I've noticed recently with recent elections, we're getting too many representatives coming to their position with this my way or no way at all attitude. That is a recipe for polarization, for gridlock, for paralysis. And we can't afford that right now, given the challenge that we face. Now, with experience comes knowledge, knowledge about the issues and the challenges facing the district, knowledge on how to get things done in Washington, too. And that's what I bring to the table, that openness and willingness to work with folks back home and with my colleagues in D.C. Again, it's why I'm ranked as one of the more independent members of Congress, because I can stand up to those powerful special interests and the political leadership of both parties when I disagree with them. And I have from time to time. But the ability to come together to get things done. And right now, we need that now more than ever. We're battling this hidden enemy. It's not a typical enemy with bullets and guns and terrorism and bombs. It's a biological enemy. And it requires all of us to be on the same page to defeat it so that we can grow out of it and make America better and stronger. And that's why Mark and I agree on fundamental public health measures that we all need to be taking. Washing our hands, maintaining distancing, wearing a mask to protect one another. Unfortunately, our Republican opponents aren't doing any of this. They're not wearing masks. They're going out. They're shaking hands. They're involved in large group. That is not the leadership that we need from the Oval Office to people back home here. We're all in this together. We can overcome this virus and rebuild America even stronger. That's the discussion that we should be having today. And that's the one that I hope we're going to be able to get into in a little more detail.
All right, Representative Kind, this question comes to you first. The presidential candidates and outside groups are spending advertising money to cast aspersions on the character of other candidates in national races. To what extent should voters consider personal character in choosing an elected leader?
I think character does matter. It matters a lot because it forms the basis of your decisions. But character needs to come with integrity, with ethics, with a sense of decency and a value that we need to share as Americans. How do we treat each other decently, with respect, even though someone may look differently than us or sound differently or act differently? That's the mosaic of America. And I believe our diversity is one of the sources of our greatest strength rather than something to be feared. And yet the current president keeps pushing those buttons to divide our communities, to divide people in our nation, which is a disastrous policy at a time of a global pandemic when we all need to be working together to help and protect and keep each other safe, and then thinking of ways of how we rebuild America. And just recently, I had a virtual town hall with Vice President Biden where we talked about a rural economic opportunity agenda, what we need to do to restore the greatness of rural Wisconsin and America again. And Vice President Biden has this Build Back Better plan. But when the current president was asked this question on a recent Fox News interview to adopt a lexicon of Wisconsin, it was deer in the headlights. He had no idea on any type of strategy to defeat the virus or what a second term would look like under his leadership. Again, that failure of leadership is what we can't afford in order to protect each other and to rebuild America again.
Dr. Newman, what about you? Character matter more for a member of Congress or the skill sets necessary to just do the job?
Oh, I think that character is absolutely fundamental to doing this job or any professional job. What you alluded to in your question, you know, casting aspersions is what I'd like to comment on. And when we get into a campaign and we see this way too often, how the ads that come up on the TV are in other forms are aimed at destroying the appearance of another person's character. My son, who spent some time on social media and so forth, he's being bombarded these days with some of these ads. And he comes and reports them to me, and we have a little chuckle. But what I remind him about is, look how every one of those is reaching and digging to grab onto your fear reaction. That emotion in our center of our nervous system is one that's fundamental to survival of creatures that have a central nervous system. You can see it from the lowest forms to human beings. And if we can hook that fear reaction, then we close down people's appreciation, their ability to think, their ability to really appreciate what's going on. And that circumvents exactly what I was talking about earlier, that possibility of having honest and respectful conversation, because we are triggering that reactivity that allows propaganda type communication to happen rather than healthful, real democracy forms of communication.
And Ezra, if I may, we're seeing that character assassination on the other side right now with the Republican candidates for the seat. They've decided to turn against each other in the primary rather than focus on the needs of the people of this district and our nation right now. And again, I submit that is not the leadership we need to emerge from a global pandemic and to rebuild America so we're stronger.
Dr. Newman, the next question comes to you. Healthcare is an area where there seems to be at least some maybe nominal difference between you as candidates. Representative Kind touts the Affordable Care Act as a major accomplishment to which he contributed during his time in office. Dr. Newman, you vocally support a single-payer Medicare for all system. Please explain and defend your position on the federal government's role in healthcare.
Our country has tried at least six times to create a form of universal health care delivery, dating all the way back to the Wilson administration. And it's failed on every one of these attempts because of special interests that didn't want to lose their opportunity to make profits off of our desperation when we get sick. Each of these historical events has its own story, but it's led up to where we are today. So that we have a multitude of smaller or larger private insurance companies that have stuck themselves between the patient and the doctor. They are not healthcare, but they are in a sweet spot for making good profits, profiteering off of the system as it is. And so they are desperate to not have it really change. And the Accountable Care Act accomplished a couple of things. Besides expanding availability to a lot more people and also stipulating what these insurance companies needed to do, it also allowed all Americans to recognize that it is not an issue of commodity only, but rather a right for all of us to be able to experience good health services. So my assessment and deep study of the issue is that we need to have a single payer system in order to get rid of the real villains in our system as it is now. And it's going to take a lot of work because, as I just said, the conversation in the public arena is being bombarded by these interests that don't want to allow us to move to a system like that which is proposed by Congresswoman Jayapal, H.R. 1384. It's not a pie-in-the-sky idea. It's a real piece of legislation, and it's very reflective and even better than what the Canadians have. I think this could move forward, and it could get us to where we need to eventually get to, because we will get to a single-payer system sometime. It's just how long and how painful we're going to make the road getting there.
Representative Kind, you were involved in passing Obamacare. Is Obamacare the ultimate path forward, or would you like to see a single-payer system eventually as well?
Well, the work to improve healthcare is unfinished, and we need to continue to strive for better care, better quality, at a better price for all Americans. Listen, Mark and I agree that we need universal healthcare coverage so that all Americans have access to affordable and quality healthcare in their lives. It is a fundamental right, and there's still too many gaps in the system. But listen, we currently have a president, along with Republicans in Congress, who are doing everything they can to repeal the Affordable Care Act. In fact, there's a court case right now working its way to the Supreme Court that could repeal the entire measure. And they don't have a plan B. They don't have an alternative. to replace it with. That means people with pre-existing conditions will be in jeopardy of losing coverage again or seeing their premiums skyrocket where it's completely unaffordable. One of the reasons I supported the Affordable Care Act a little while back, because I had a chance to meet with a young mother who told me the story about her son who suffered a seizure in her womb. And so the very first breath he took in his life, he was literally uninsurable because he had a pre-existing condition. We cannot go back to that world in this country. Yes, there's ways of improving access to care. For the life of me, I don't know why our state legislature doesn't take the BadgerCare expansion money so we can cover the most vulnerable citizens in Wisconsin. 38 states have done it. 19 of them with Republican governors have done it, and yet they refuse to do that simple fundamental things that could extend more coverage to our most vulnerable population here in Wisconsin. But you repeal that act, you also take away young adults staying on their parents' plans. You take away free prevention and wellness visits for seniors in Medicare. And you take away the protections against annual and lifetime payment caps. But most importantly, you eliminate protection for individuals with pre-existing conditions, which describe virtually all of us as we get older. We're going to develop some pre-existing conditions. The Affordable Care Act protects those things right now. Yes, there's room for improvement. We can talk a little bit more about what we need to do to get better value of care at a better price. But that was the largest expansion of healthcare coverage since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s, passage of the Affordable Care Act. And there are ways of making it even better.
Congressman Kind, the White House and Congress are continuing to work on more COVID-19 relief, even heading into the weekend. Additional unemployment payments have recently expired, and after months of non-payment or partial payments, many renters now face eviction from their homes. But with mounting deficits, how much help can the government really afford to give?
Well, we have to step in. We have to provide a bridge to the other side until we can develop a vaccine, inoculate people, and keep them safe. But in the meantime, we've got to learn to live with this virus in our midst, reduce the spread, contain it, and mitigate it as best we can, and save lives. And so this next package is going to be important, of extending unemployment benefits with supplemental payments. I have a paper mill in Wisconsin Rapids, Versal, that just announced that they're going out of business. That's over 900 workers and their families who will now be laid off and probably going on unemployment. And they're going to need that additional assistance to make ends meet until they transition to what's next. There are people, as you mentioned, renters who are going to be at risk of being thrown out on the streets unless we maintain that emergency rental assistance program. We have nutrition programs that are going to be reduced funding for, and the food needs in our communities are growing exponentially. And in a country as great as ours, we can provide that bridge and help the people in the short term until we can let science develop the vaccine to truly defeat this virus once and for all. I'm hoping we can reach that agreement shortly, hopefully by the end of this week. I'm involved in those discussions right now with my Republican colleagues to find that common ground so we can move forward. Because the more we do now, Ezra, the less painful this economic recession can be, the less the hole will be that we have to dig out from, and the shorter the recovery period when it comes time to start rebuilding America again. But if we fail to act, it's only going to get worse. I'm afraid we're going to lose more lives in the process.
Dr. Newman, a lot of people need help, but the solutions being looked at cost real money. How much can the government afford to do?
So I think there's two aspects to what we're facing with the pandemic. There's the biological threat, and now we're talking, I think, about the economic threat. So I want to focus on that. And when I look at our economy, I see that it is a network of trusting relationships. People say, I'm going to pay my my mortgage, or I'm going to pay my rent, or I'm used to being paid my salary. And so we have all of these relationships of trust between all the members, thousands and thousands of interactions and contracts that are carrying on. Once these start to fall, it's like a house of cards, or it's like dominoes. And that could be a disaster, because this economy, this place of relationships that we live with in our communities, is that's our life. That's how we experience living with one another. We have the great fortune of being in a as Congressman Kind said, a wonderful, great country with much larger economy that allows us to support one another. And so we do need to make interventions. We cannot allow this house of cards to begin to fall and turn into just a shambles. When our country faces an emergency, we respond. When it was the Second World War, we responded because we felt, my ancestors, my father and mother felt like our democratic tradition was facing a threat that it had never faced before. But we didn't stop and count pennies at that point. We said we need to go forward and we need to deal with the stress. And that's what we're facing today. We will get through this, but it's going to be really, really horrible if we allow all of those relationships to crumble.
And Ezra, just another important feature of what we're working on right now, and I'm trying to get this done, but there's a great need for personal protection equipment. We're running into shortages with our healthcare providers, need to up the testing with reagents, which is in short supply, and developing that national strategy of how we can defeat this virus. But again, unfortunately, we have a leader in the White House who says it is what it is and says it's going to magically disappear. And in fact, he just posted something that Facebook and Twitter had to take down because it's blatantly false and it's against all the science and all the facts that are out there. Again, that is not the leadership that our country needs right now. And it's something that we got to work on.
Democratic primary debate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, as you hear, is well underway here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Representative Ron Kind, the incumbent, and Dr. Mark Newman, kind enough to join us today. Dr. Newman, President Trump initially tweeted that widespread mail-in voting would lead to fraud. Then later, he tweeted that Florida voters should feel secure voting by mail. Where do you stand on election security issues like widespread voting by mail?
It's fundamental that our country and our states and our local communities help people to vote. That is essential to our history of having a representative democracy. And we want to make that as possible and as smooth as we can possibly do it. 5 states have mail-in voting, and they do very well. There is no fundamental issue that does not allow us to do that very well. And it works well for allowing all of the citizens in those states to have that opportunity to do their duty and their right to express their voices through the electoral process. I think that what I see and hear about, you know, the potential fraud and so forth is another reaching back to dig deep into that heart of some people and say, this is fearful. You need to be afraid of this. Because that vulnerability to snatching that fear reactivity of fight or flight that gets our stress hormones up and our adrenaline rushing clogs our ability to participate as good citizens. And so that's what I see going on. It's not a real argument.
Representative Kind, what about you? Do you favor the higher levels of mail-in voting in light of the pandemic?
I do. And it suggests that there's blatant fraud involved with voting by mail is blatantly inaccurate and false. And it's quite frankly an insult to our states and our county clerks who are in charge of administering these elections. And it's kind of curious that the president doesn't have a problem allowing the state of Florida to move forward on voting by mail, since that's what he does. In fact, everyone within the White House and his administration are comfortable by voting by mail. And yet here in Wisconsin, we've been doing it for years and we haven't had any problems and no allegation of fraud or abuse. And especially now, we're in the midst of this virus, which is taking lives, we ought to be giving all voters the option to vote safely from home. And the pressure it's going to put on our poll workers, who are usually manned by older citizens on election day, is something that we witnessed last spring. It was hard to fill those positions just for poll watchers. We had to deploy our National Guard in Wisconsin in civilian clothes in order to pull it off. And even then, many polling stations had to be shut down. I don't know why the president decided to politicize this. I know as many Republicans as Democrats and independents want the choice to safely vote from home. And so I'm not quite sure what he's trying to do here to undermine something that's been going on for years in states like Wisconsin and throughout our country.
Congressman Kind, as schools are deciding whether it's safe to meet in person, many districts are hosting more digital offerings than ever before. In spite of the added expense of new technology, the president has threatened to cut federal funding for schools that do not fully open in person. How can Congress offer needed support to districts without placing students at unnecessary risk?
Well, that too is part of what we're trying to get into this next COVID package, the resources schools need in order to open safely, to protect not only the children, but the teachers, the staff, the administration. I've been on the virtual meetings with our superintendents, principals, and teachers over the last few weeks to get feedback from them on what exactly they need to do this safely. And it will be a challenge because this virus doesn't discriminate based on age. And it could be very dangerous to 1/4 of our teachers who have this core morbidity that makes them more susceptible to adverse reaction if they do get exposed to the virus. But again, the president's making this silly threat where he constitutionally and legally cannot do that. Congress is the one that appropriates money, and he can't just decide what he's going to send out the door and what he chooses to sit on. But having said that, he's shown great disdain to the rule of law. And he has decided to do things which is blatantly illegal or unconstitutional, only to be challenged in court, knowing that it could take up to a year before this gets resolved through our federal court system. So we should stop the threats. He should work with our best medical and scientific experts, along with the school districts and higher ed institutions who are grappling with these same decisions right now, and figure out the best way to do this that's going to keep people safe and keep them alive without these unnecessary threats hanging over their head.
Dr. Newman, what's it going to take for schools to be able to open safely and offer in-person education, and how can Congress support that?
Well, one thing that it won't take, and that is to have one-size-fits-all response to the pandemic. The experience of the pandemic or the epidemic is that it's very regional. Each little area of our country, each population has different experiences at different times. And so when we talk about our schools, I am so grateful that we can see our democracy functioning in, for example, school boards and local election, a local government, I mean, because the people that are in charge of making these kinds of decisions for our children and our families are deeply, deeply investing in making the right choice. What they require from the federal government is better coordination of efforts, better examples of best practice, better resources in order to make the right choices and then have what they need to execute them. But when it comes to opening the schools, there is no one who will better guard and protect and make decisions about the well-being of their children than the parents. And the parents have direct access to the school boards, and the school boards are collaborating very closely with local governments on the county level or the city level or the state level in order to make these very, very hard decisions because of so many different values that are at issue. The federal government can support them, and that's another advantage of having a large country like we have.
Dr. Newman, we've seen the nation's attention turn to the difficult challenges facing minority communities in our country, especially Black Americans. What reforms should Congress approach to deal with racism?
Oh, our racism is what I call our original sin from the origin of our country, from 1619, when the first forced immigrants from Africa came to join our country. And we have struggled with this for over 400 years as a country. We struggled with it, particularly in the Civil War, and we are still struggling with the need to recognize that we are not one heritage. We are not one tradition. We are a multitude of traditions. And this is the wealth and beauty and richness of our American tradition. The African American heritage is not one that should be integrated like into the white tradition, but rather to recognize that African Americans see their country as their America. And they have an appreciation of their life over their generations that has its wealth and its richness. Sometimes we think, well, we have to figure out how we're going to tolerate one another. certainly I think that's falling way short. Tolerance is sort of a weak man's way of building walls. What we really need is hospitality. That is that appreciation that my heritage is maybe different than yours, but I want to learn about yours. I want to appreciate and celebrate it. And we have so many different traditions that we need to continuously try to raise up and recognize that they contribute to the American experience. And our Black American heritage is a very prominent one that we have as part of our national wealth.
Representative Kind, what's the role of Congress in alleviating racism in America?
Well, Congress has an important role, but we all have an important role, Ezra, to overcome the racial divisions. And Mark is right. This is a legacy of slavery, a 400-year history that we've never truly come to grips with and overcome and reconciled as a nation. I've always viewed our diversity as a nation as one of the sources of our greatest strength, not something to be feared. And yet we have leaders in our midst now who are stoking those racial divisions, figuring out ways of how to divide our communities, how to divide families even over this issue. Listen, I just recently lost a very dear friend of mine who I served with on the Ways and Means Committee. I loved him greatly, Representative John Lewis. And he was a shining example of speaking out, of action, of doing something, of, as he would call it, getting into good kind of trouble, necessary trouble, peaceful trouble, in order to demand full equality for all of our citizens. And I drew great inspiration from his life's mission. I had many conversations with him. In fact, one of the highlights of my time in Congress was a few years ago, I was able to take my two sons down to Selma for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And John Lewis delivered a beautiful speech about racial reconciliation in our country. President Obama, I thought, delivered his seminal speech in his administration, connecting the dots of our racial history, but also reminding us that progress has been made. It's not coming as fast or as soon as we would like, but that moral arc of history is bending upwards, and we need to recognize those accomplishments. But we're not there yet in our effort to form a more perfect union. We're never going to achieve perfection, but it's important for all of us to strive to make our society, make our lives together a more perfect union. And that is unfinished work. One thing I would love to be able to see Congress do if I had a magic wand is restore Title V of the Voting Rights Act, which was struck down, I thought, erroneously in federal court, so that everyone has a fair opportunity to at least vote in our democracy. And because of that, they've made it more difficult. We've renamed that bill now, the John Lewis Act, and hopefully we can get the Senate to act because the House has passed that numerous times. That would be a good place to start as far as healing racial divisions, making sure that all Americans have access to the ballot box.
Representative Kind, the platform that got President Trump elected in 2016 included immigration reform and border security as major parts. With some 75,000 undocumented workers in Wisconsin, what would be your approach to immigration reform?
Well, we do need comprehensive immigration reform. The lack of it is hurting us economically. Now, I meet with family farmers all the time. Many of them do rely on migrant labor help to keep those dairy operations going. I meet with a lot of businesses that hire migrant labor as well. And I think we do need a pathway for those who are currently undocumented. But right now, again, we have an administration that seems to be attacking even DACA students, those dreamers who are brought here through no fault of their own. I had a meeting with many of those students a while back up in Arcadia. And at that meeting, the valedictorian of the Arcadia High School and of Whitehall High School were DACA kids. And yet neither one of them went on to school because they don't qualify for in-state tuition and they don't qualify for the need-based financial aid programs that I was able to benefit from as I went to school. That means we're leaving a lot of talent on the sideline, and it's only hurting us economically. But we need to establish those rules of how we can have lawful, legal immigration in our country rather than just shutting down the border, shutting down refugee status, putting children in cages and separating them from their parents, which is abhorrent. And yet that's the type of leadership the current administration is providing on this issue. A few years ago, we had a good bipartisan comprehensive bill that overwhelmingly passed the Senate. Unfortunately, the Republican leadership in the House refused to bring it forward. I'm hoping we can get back to that that base bill and finally move it together as one nation and start healing these racial divisions.
Dr. Newman, how would you handle immigration reform if voters send you to Washington?
I think we begin by recognizing the rich wealth of what immigration has represented for the history of our country. This is the continuous source of new life and new traditions and new appreciations of the fullness of what it means to be a human being when we bring these traditions into one land, one country. And currently what we experience today, I think, is we are really taking advantage of our most recent new people coming from, for example, Central America, for all kinds of political gains that turn them into scapegoats. And there's really no reason for us to have undocumented anybody in this country. When I lived for some months in Europe, everyone had an identification, a government-issued identification card of some kind. And if you were a visitor, as I was, I had mine. And so if someone comes into the country, we should have a documentation for all 330-plus million people that live in this land, and that should not even exist. But ultimately, I think that we need to relish the goodness that we have of all the people that come into our land and integrate them into the future of our country, because we are going to face more and more migration of human being issues in the world. As we are facing the climate change crisis, we will have regions of the world expanding that are no longer habitable. And the people that are currently living there will need to go elsewhere. And so there will be huge migratory phenomena over the next 50 years that have been reported by the Academy of Science. And we need to be establishing methods and management ways and not just kicking the can, I guess, down the road and using the immigrant people as a whipping boy for other political issues. We need to face the issues and deal with them forthrightly.
You're listening to the Democratic primary debate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Joining me today are Dr. Mark Newman, whom you've just heard, and the incumbent, Representative Ron Kind. They will face each other in the August 11th primary in the Democratic Party. The Republicans also have a primary that day, and the winner of each primary will face each other in the general election in November. Let's see. This question goes to Dr. Newman, and it is, the 3rd District is made up of more than 11,000 square miles of land, much of it being farmland, of course. Farmers have taken a beating over several years, and the pandemic is presenting even tougher challenges for them. As a member of Congress, what can you do for the farmers here in the 3rd District?
I think that the Congress has a lot of important responsibilities towards all of our farmers in the country, and particularly in Wisconsin. Since the 30s, we have had the Farm Bill that is probably one of the most major pieces of legislation that comes through our Congress every 5 years. And this legislation has molded our farming and agricultural industry. I can even find parallels sometimes by the way our farmers are treated to the way I was treated in the American healthcare industry that I worked in as a physician. And what I mean by that is, as a physician, I felt sometimes that I was being treated like I was a cog in this big machine for making profits for other people, and they were treating me as just a unit of production, whereas I believed that as a physician, I was the critical issue. I was the critical factor, because that's where those relationships of healer and patient actually occur, and we're not just mechanical things. And this is the same thing for our farmers. They are the principal issue, the principal reason that we have a farm bill, not because they're just places where we produce stuff so that it can turn into profits for very tight processing and supply chains. For example, the processing of meat and the meat plants. We have four major meat processors, and they can treat our farmers like they're just the units of production, whereas the farmers are actually the bottom layer, the fundamental issue. They're the ones that protect our land. They're the ones that create the human community between our urban centers, and they're being crushed. They are being crushed by large corporation entities that are buying up the territories of land that the 1,000 farms that have been lost over the last year in Wisconsin. What we want to do is we want to preserve that life of the small and moderate sized family farms, because they're the ones that love the land, they love their livestock, and they love the real urban community. 57% of the people in the third district don't live in urban centers. They're not all farmers, but they participate in that fabric of human connectivity in our rural areas that our farm families are the fundamental basis of.
Representative Kind, farmers have been having a tough few years. What can Congress do?
A lot, Ezra. Listen, production agriculture has always been one of the backbones of our state's economy, and our family farmers, backbone of our rural economy and our rural communities. And it's been heartbreaking to see record family farm bankruptcies here in Wisconsin over the last few years. And when this virus broke out, when it landed on our shores in January, I immediately came out with a 5-point family farm rescue plan, making sure that they qualified for all the small business relief programs that we were appropriating, making sure we were doing commodity surplus buy-ups to get to food banks and the food deserts to address the hunger needs that we knew we would have in our country, making sure that the commodity credit payments that were going out was done on a fair and equitable basis rather than all the payments going to huge agribusiness, which has been the formula used in the past. That's why I've been one of the leading voices in Congress to reform our farm bill, especially Title I subsidy program, where 80% of the taxpayer dollars are going to the 20% of the largest agribusinesses in our country. They're using it to consolidate their operation, to buy up family farms around them, to ramp up production, which depresses prices, and it squeezes our family farmers. I've also introduced a bipartisan bill to establish a national commission to study the causes of over-surplus of commodity products, which is driving prices down, making it hard for our farmers to get a good market price so they can pay their bills and stay in business, which is all they ever want. They don't want huge subsidy programs from Washington to be dependent on. They want a good market to sell into. And I also add that the president's trade war has been very hurtful to our family farmers and our manufacturers here in Wisconsin because of the lack of market access, where we can export some of our excess surplus to a hungry world. When the president engages in these trade wars with even our closest friends and allies, he invites retaliation, and that usually targets our farmers and manufacturers. We all know this, and yet he continues to do it. I'm also co-chair of the bipartisan Organic Caucus. And we have the largest organic co-op in the nation, Organic Valley, in the heart of our congressional district. And that is a choice that those members, that those farmers are making for sustainable agriculture and how they're going to treat the land and their livestock. And it's a choice consumers want, what type of products that they want to consume or have their children consume. Many of them are choosing organic for a variety of reasons. So there's a lot more that we can and should be doing for our family farmers, including immigration policy, which has a direct impact on them, but also including closing the digital divide, which I'm on a national task force to do right now. This virus has highlighted that digital divide and the economic and the educational inequities that flow from it. This, too, has a direct adverse impact on farmers who are as digital or need to be as anyone else. But when you have these huge gaps in service, especially in our rural parts of the state, it makes it hard for them to be competitive and stay in business.
Representative Kind, you're the only Democrat in Wisconsin's congressional delegation to receive an A rating from the National Rifle Association. Does your position on gun rights put you at odds with your party?
Listen, I don't think it's accurate that I got that recently. But nonetheless, I have been respectful of Second Amendment rights. But with those rights comes responsibility. And that's why I recently supported comprehensive background check legislation. I mean, if the argument is we need to keep guns out of the wrong people's hands, violent convicted felons or people with mental illness, how do you do that without a comprehensive background check in order to intercept those people so they can't go out and legally purchase these weapons? I've also been in favor of the red flag laws, too, where people with mental illness and have been adjudicated as potentially harmful to themselves and others, that law enforcement can seize their weapons in order to protect them or those around them. Unfortunately, that's been opposed by the NRA and by other people, including most Republicans, when that legislation came up. So I think we can strike that right balance. But Listen, I'm a kid. I'm a product of Wisconsin, having been born and raised here. I love to hunt. I love to fish. I love to backpack and boat and hike and bike like most Wisconsin do. I have multiple guns myself, and nothing's brought me greater joy than the chance to be able to hunt with my boys and fish and enjoy these great natural resources. It's why I was one of the leaders to make sure that we got the Great American Outdoors Act finally passed in legislation. It will be the largest public investment we make in public lands in our nation's history to deal with the maintenance backlog of our parks and our refuges. I'm co-chairing the National Park Caucus, and I was the founder of the National Wildlife Refuge Caucus in Congress. So that, too, is a big part of the Wisconsin DNA, outdoor recreation, our natural resources that need to be protected and preserved. And hunting is a part of that tradition, too. And I'm not shy to participate in that, but we need to strike the right measure with gun safety measures, which I think we can do, while still being respectful of Second Amendment rights in the state.
Dr. Newman, your policy statement on gun control defines firearm violence as a public health risk. What's your position on the Second Amendment?
I think that's a useful frame to think about the real risk, the real concern that people have relative to the presence of firearms in our community is the risk of injury. And we have, as a community, been dealing with risk all the time for centuries. We see risk to our health, and we meet those challenges by instituting different forms of regulation. For example, even just as a minor example, the use of seatbelts back in the 60s and what a big difference it made by managing that risk of auto crash injury. Certainly, all Americans have the right to own guns that has been accorded by our Constitution and the interpretation of the Supreme Court. But that right comes up against all kinds of other rights. And there is no right, either God-given or constitutionally mandated, that is completely contained in itself. And so when those rights butt up once against the other, we need to have ways of managing the difference between people's rights and conflict. And a family has a right to raise its family while managing the risk of health injury to their children. And so those legislation, those regulations, those management, these conflicting, butting up against one another rights has to be done in regional and local and state ways. And they're not necessarily the same for the whole country, but I certainly agree that the red flag law is a good idea, and the background checks should be universal on a national plane.
Our time is drawing pretty short here, so brief answers to this next question. And we're starting with Dr. Newman. The U.S. has spent trillions of dollars in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, fighting the war on terror. What is the role, in about a minute, what is the role of the U.S. military in maintaining peace in the world?
So we're talking about our Pentagon military and its engagement in international issues of stress. And I think the most important part is that we engage and use our military in collaborative with other nations and not in unilateral military adventures. One concern that I have, particularly when it's just a unilateral engagement, is that our Pentagon military gets used for accessing resources for maybe corporation interests or international corporation interests, and it really is not a threat that I and my neighbors experience as Americans.
All right, Representative Kind, to you, what's the role of the U.S. military in maintaining world peace?
Well, I would correct that. I don't think it's the role of the U.S. military. It's the role of the civilian leadership of our country to avoid unnecessary wars, to avoid sending our young men and women in uniform in conflict situations that are not necessary. And the best way to accomplish that is through the building of alliances, having friends and allies around the world that you can work with, and through the instruments of soft power, be able to de-escalate conflict situations so our military doesn't have to be on the front line of solving the world's issues. Unfortunately, this president today has taken us off that field of global leadership. He has specifically targeted and attacked some of our closest friends and allies that we've had for many decades, including our NATO allies, threatening to withdraw from that and to cast aspersions on the democracies of the world who are our natural allies. And unfortunately, he's shown a penchant for coddling up to dictators, whether it's Vladimir Putin or President Xi or Kim Jong-un of North Korea. That is not the type of leadership that our country needs or that the globe demands right now to maintain a peaceful situation.
All right. I want to thank each of you for joining us, and I want to give you each an opportunity to share in about a minute again, starting with you, Representative Kind. What should voters know about you that differentiates you from your opponent when they head to the polls on Tuesday?
Well, Ezra, thanks again for hosting and for Wisconsin Public Radio and for the Eau Claire Chamber for doing it. Mark, always a joy to be with you. I have great respect and admiration for you and the issues that you bring to the table. But listen, we are in a toxic political environment. It's way too polarized. It's too hyper-partisan. This is not healthy for our democracy. We need elected officials who aren't afraid to get in the same room with people, especially people of a different party with different ideas and different thoughts, and respectfully listen to them. And I found through the years that by doing that, there's a lot of common ground that can be had that you can work on together, that you can accomplish. That's why I've been ranked as one of the most bipartisan members of Congress, one of the most effective legislators. We need more of that leadership in Washington, in Madison, and back home on the main streets of America to unite this country, to defeat this virus, and to rebuild America so we emerge better and stronger and more equitable at the end of the day. Thank you.
Representative Kind, thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Newman, as a final question to you, in about a minute, what should voters know that differentiates you from your opponent when they go to the polls on Tuesday?
What I can say is that I feel like I'm at a job interview. And the job that I'm asking is to represent the people of Western Wisconsin and Central Wisconsin. And I believe that that representation is taking our values, our traditions, those deeply held beliefs of our community, and bringing them into the legislative process where they get codified into law and regulation and policy. So with that job interview before me, I bring two assets that I think are very important for completing this task, completing this job. One of them is my vision of what good governance, and the other one is my personal integrity. When I was a medical teacher of medical students, I would tell them, you'll learn a lot of pharmacy, physiology, pathophysiology, but the most important thing you need to learn is that trust relationship between you and your patients is sacred. And that is the thing that makes you a great physician. That is the reason we're doing what we're doing as physicians. I believe the same thing for our legislative process, when the people we send. And my vision for governance is that we do the things together that we can't do as individuals, because there are many things that are needed for us to live full, rich, complete human lives. We can survive individually. We cannot thrive unless we do it together.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Newman. This concludes WPR's Democratic Debate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. I'd like to thank both of our candidates today, Dr. Mark Newman and Congressman Ron Kind. They face each other on the August 11th Democratic primary that's coming up on Tuesday. The winning Democrat will face the prevailing Republican candidate in the 3rd District, either Jesse Eben or Derek Van Orden. A debate between those candidates is already up on our website, WPR.org. You can find this debate on our website and the other one at WPR.org. Scroll down to the announcements section, and there it will be. Thanks to Dawn Jewell, Rick Ryer, and Dean Kallenbach for providing help. Our webcast was made possible by the Eau Claire Area Chamber of Commerce and Wind Technology of Eau Claire. Special thanks to WPR journalists John Davis, Hope Kerwin, Rich Kramer, Elizabeth Domes Harder, Shireen Seward, and Rob Mentzer for their input on today's program last week as well. And you can access the archive of both third district debates at WPR.org. I'm Ezra Wall. This has been the Democratic primary debate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District from Wisconsin Public Radio.